So welcome back to Healing the Earth Radio, and I'm here on the air with Lara Hansen. Lara, how are you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Excellent. It's great to have you on the air. And so I've introduced you as the Chief Climate Change Scientist with the World Wildlife Fund, and I wonder if you can begin maybe with maybe a little bit of a breakdown, I guess, an introductory breakdown. We can go more into detail as the interview continues, just as what's going on with the climate now, because there's a recent article in the Star I know that said that climate's breaking record extremes. There's lots of record weather temperatures and different extremes going on. And I wonder if you can maybe help us make a bit of sense out of everything that's going on right now.
Right.
What kind of records have been broken these days?
Yeah, well, just to sort of step back for a moment, climate change is, in my mind, just one of the most pressing as well as interesting environmental questions currently. It's not a new issue. It's not something that people just suddenly woke up in the late 90s when it was getting warmer and warmer and said, oh my goodness, we have a problem. We have been monitoring increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere directly since the 1950s and have had a very clear picture of how they were increasing in concentration.
Mm-hmm.
And the physics is very simple, that as you increase the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, you basically are making a thicker and thicker blanket around the Earth and making it warmer. And along with a warming world, you change a lot of other parameters as well. And those have culminated in a pretty spectacular, although in a disturbing manner, year in 2005.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like this increasing heat will now make 2005 the hottest year on record. As of October, that was the prediction. The World Meteorological Organization won't give the official numbers until later this month or early in January for what the certainty on that is, but the United States NASA predicted in October that we were going to see the hottest year on record. Because of this heat, we're seeing the ice in the Arctic melting, and this was the least icy year in the Arctic ever. There's an amount of ice that melts every year. That's called the seasonal ice. But there's also perennial ice that isn't supposed to go away from the Arctic. And what we're seeing now is that the extent of that ice is decreasing. And this year had the smallest amount of that ice ever on record. Additionally, at the same time, the Caribbean waters are getting hotter and hotter. And this year we saw some of the highest heat intensity in those waters that we have ever seen. And that is also measured by the U.S. government satellites. The outcome of that heat is that you frequently get coral bleaching, which is very damaging to an incredibly diverse ecosystem type. And the only thing that stopped us from having the most dramatic bleaching we've ever seen in the Caribbean was that all of that heat in the Caribbean was also fostering more intense hurricanes, which leads us to the fact that this was also the most active, most intense hurricane season we have on record. There were 26 storms. Not all of them were hurricanes. Some of them were tropical storms. We had the most that developed into hurricanes. We had the most that developed into intense hurricanes, which means one of the higher categories of hurricane. We had the most Category 5 hurricanes, which means that winds are over 155 miles an hour. And those actually do a lot of damage, not only to human structures on land, but the corals themselves can be additionally impacted by that.
Mm-hmm.
These were the most expensive hurricanes, although with storm cost, you have to keep in mind that we're also undergoing inflation and things become more valuable, and storms will always get more and more expensive. And we're seeing record drought around the planet. We're seeing it in the Amazon. We're seeing it in Western North America.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an array of things that we're seeing going on. The Montreal meetings began actually with an interesting study in the scientific journal Nature that showed that the thermohaline circulation, the Gulf Stream in the Atlantic that keeps the waters of the Gulf Stream warm but also acts to cool the planet by replacing hot tropical water with cool Arctic water, there seems to be some evidence that that's now slowing down. And that, of course, is the premise of The Day After Tomorrow,
mm-hmm.
which is a bit of a dramatic film.
Mm-hmm.
But the essence of what that means and what an important role that plays in global climate should not be lost.
Mm-hmm. Some people speculate that that could lead to an ice age in Europe. And I'm sure that's a bit of an exaggeration, but can you talk a bit about how that's affected?
Well, it would, in fact, make Europe cooler. It would make Northern Europe cooler. And the way that that happens is that it's called the global conveyor belt. It moves heat from the tropics, where we get the most solar irradiation, the most heat energy, gets collected, and then it moves, that warm water moves north, where it gets exchanged with cooler water. And as that warm water moves north, it sort of buffers the environments, the terrestrial environments that are near it. But if the thermohaline circulation shuts down, what ends up happening is that you lose that movement of hot tropical water north, and that hot tropical water stays in the tropics. So you no longer have an infusion, essentially, of warmth from the tropics to the higher latitudes.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can maybe talk a bit about the tropics. Like, I'm interested to know about what exactly coral bleaching means and what that means for the ocean's ecosystems.
Mm-hmm. Well, coral bleaching is perhaps one of the most dramatic effects of climate change, and one of the most easily attributable. If you look at the historic records of corals, which are pretty good, they go back quite a ways because corals are quite beautiful, and as people have traveled around the world, we've made note of them. And in the historical records, there are occasional events of coral bleaching. There'll be a small local bleaching event that could be attributed to a change in temperature or to a change in salinity because of perhaps increased storm events that caused more freshwater runoff into the ocean. Corals don't like it when it becomes more freshwater than cool water. Or sort of an input of nutrients. Coral like low nutrient water. But around in the early 1980s, we started seeing a phenomenon called global coral bleaching. And we would see as the summer waters warmed, we were crossing a threshold which corals could live well at, and they started to bleach. And what bleaching is that corals are actually a symbiotic organism. It's an animal that's called the coral, and then within the tissue of the animal is a plant known as a zooxanthellae, or an algae, or a dinoflagellate. And as water temperatures warm, that relationship becomes challenged. Conditions aren't as good as they should be, and the zooxanthellae either leave or die. And that causes a problem for the coral, because being a symbiotic organism, they're actually getting energy from the photosynthesis of that plant living in their tissue. And when that plant leaves and stops producing that extra energy that they're harvesting from it, they essentially start to starve to death. If conditions return to a favorable state, they can become recolonized by the dinoflagellates because they also live in the water column, or even some residual dinoflagellates in their tissue can reproduce and recolonize. But we know that one of the key things that started happening when water started warming and we'd see these global events is that as small an increase in temperature as 1 to 2 degrees Celsius above the thermal maxima that those corals normally see can cause this bleaching event. So when people say we've already seen 0.6 degrees warming globally from climate change and they think, oh, that's not a very big number, if you get to 1 degree, you're potentially having coral bleaching happening every year. And as corals bleach and don't get a chance to recover, you slowly lose those systems. And those ecosystems are very crucial. Coral reefs have very high biodiversity, which isn't only beneficial to their location and not only beneficial to tourism and people who like to see reefs and to the corals themselves, but they're beneficial for the ecosystems that get energy from these very diverse, very high energy systems, including a lot of fish that are economically very important. There are estimates that the coral reefs of Southeast Asia and the South Pacific feed something like 1 billion people in Asia alone. So these systems are incredibly important, and they're at a very close limit to where they're comfortable living. So small increases in temperature can have very dramatic and big effects.
Hmm. I remember reading something from a 1999 conference on coral reefs and ocean ecosystems, and some scientists were beginning to wonder if it's too late to save them, or if it's... I think the topic of this one discussion was time to give up on them or something like that. And I wonder if you know, like, what the general consensus is among scientists, like, if considering that a rise in temperature is inevitable, is it? What do you think the fate is of these coral reefs?
Well, there have been. I know the meeting that you're talking about. They actually had a statement that came out of it to the effect of many corals will become extinct, or corals, the end of coral reefs.
Mm.
I don't believe that we are going to lose all coral reefs. We will not lose all coral reef species.
Yeah.
We will dramatically change coral reefs. There are some species that are more tolerant, but they provide somewhat different functions. There are some zooxanthellae, the algae that live in the coral, that are more tolerant, but they tend to not provide as much energy to their host, so you change the dynamic of the coral system. We're going to be changing the way systems work. We will not obliterate them, likely. However, mm-hmm. corals are in a particularly bad spot because in addition to their thermal tolerance limit, the other thing that we're doing by pumping more CO2 into the atmosphere is that we're actually acidifying the oceans. We're changing the pH of the oceans, something that as an introductory oceanographic student seemed impossible to me. The ocean is so large. It has such a huge buffering capacity. How could you possibly do that? But we are, as Roger Revelle said, running an enormous experiment. We have managed to put enough CO2 into the atmosphere that we can now measure the change in pH of the ocean. And what we know is that as the pH decreases, as you make the oceans more acidic, the ability of species that produce calcium carbonate skeletons and shells is impinged upon. They are no longer able to do that. And there are predictions for what areas of the world's oceans, based on these temperature and acidification regimes, will become inhospitable to corals. That's a very dramatic global effect, and what that will mean, people have only just begun to think about.
Yeah, so are oceans becoming acidic from a basic level, or are they becoming more acidic? I've never understood that, really.
Pardon?
With the change in the pH levels of the oceans, are they becoming more acidic, or are they becoming acidic for the first time?
Now you're asking me what the basic pH of the ocean is.
Yeah,
they're becoming more acidic. Ocean water is not at 7. It's not neutral.
Yeah, okay. I was always curious about that. So as we're talking about temperature changes, maybe we can talk a bit about the droughts, especially what's going on with forests. At a recent workshop I was at, had a scientist from the Canadian government in Montreal who was talking about with a two-degree rise in temperature, it's likely to see a dramatic decrease in tropical forests. And are we looking at like a droughts affecting a tropical regions and a burning of forests, or what exactly would happen there?
Well, forests are a fascinating issue. One of the things that we've always looked for forests to do is one of their ecosystem services, as we like to call them, is that they can take up CO2.
Mm-hmm.
As part of photosynthesis, plants take up CO2 and exchange it for oxygen during the day. And we've always seen forests as a fantastic carbon store. Unfortunately, what happens is that as climate change proceeds, some forest regions are becoming drier. And when forests become drier, they actually start to release carbon in two ways. One is that you change fire regimes, and we are seeing changes in fire regimes in different parts of the world. And this includes natural fire regimes, not just fire regimes caused by deforestation and burning in order to create agricultural lands. So you release carbon when forests burn, obviously. But also, as forests become drier, they just naturally release more carbon. They stop photosynthesizing as effectively. They stop growing as effectively. They also release more of the carbon that's captured in their soils when they become drier. So we sort of have a negative feedback loop to some extent. We don't know how dramatic it's going to be, but many forests that we have seen as sinks may, in fact, become sources of CO2. Further exacerbating the problems of climate change.
Mm-hmm. There's a great quote I've heard before that forests precede us and deserts dog our heels. And that's more reference to civilization, but I think it's also coming true with climate change now as well,
mm-hmm.
which I find very interesting.
Yeah.
This temperature change, I wonder, I believe it was the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I think they gave the 2 degrees Celsius mark as like a tipping point of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit about that, like where we are on the road to that, how soon it's expected to be reached, and what that means.
Right. Well, this is the current extreme need to take action and to do something about climate change. The European Union and a bunch of other scientific bodies and conservation organizations have identified 2 degrees, or quite frankly, less than 2 degrees, as the key point for avoiding dangerous climate change, which is a key provision of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Kyoto Protocol. It now looks as though actually that point to avoid dangerous is in fact below 2 degrees, and there was a report out by a group of Dutch scientists last year that said that perhaps it's as low as 1.7. Mm-hmm. Currently, then this is all in degrees Celsius, we're currently at 0.6, plus or minus 2. That is and that's actually not today, that's in 2001, which is the last time a global number was established.
Wow.
The estimate for when we will add the next 0.6 is quite soon, because we already have enough heat energy, CO2 in the atmosphere, to generate that much more. So we're already at about 1.2 to 1.4. That gives us a very small margin before we get to 2. And if you look at the IPCC predictions, that almost certainly will happen by the end of the century. There are some predictions that put it much sooner. But all of those predictions fail to include humans taking action to do something about this.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, we were to take action and do something about this, we could stabilize it too. That means we would probably slightly overshoot too and then move back down below it. And that's the key thing we have to work on, is taking action to do something about it. We can't just look at the models and ask them, when do they say we'll get there? We have to say what we need to do is dramatically reduce the emissions of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. That means changing the way we use energy, not only through conservation, but using renewable energies, clean renewable energies, rather than burning of fossil fuels, especially things like coal and oil. And we need to make decisions in our land use, in how we do land use change. We need to be thinking about climate change in our development planning and in our conservation planning. We shouldn't simply look at models and ask, when will the bad things happen?
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you want to talk a bit about what's going on in Montreal. Tony Blair, I believe, there's a quote from him saying it shouldn't be expected that governments rely on industry to reduce industrial emissions, or something like that, to that extent. And I wonder what you think about the dichotomy between government's reliance on industry and the need for action, and what we as citizens on the ground level can do, and where effective action should come from or needs to come from.
Well, in my vision, CO2 is really a pollutant. It is something that is altering the world negatively. And what we know from all of the other pollutants that we have had to deal with, that requires regulation. We did not get rid of lead because it became economically not feasible to use it. We got rid of lead because we regulated that lead was bad for the environment and bad for people, and we removed it from things like gasoline and paint. Obviously, we have not removed all of the lead from the from manufacturing processes and products, but we've gotten rid of the majority of it. The same thing is true with chlorofluorocarbons and the ozone hole. Thanks to the Montreal Protocol, we were able to reduce the amount of CFCs in the atmosphere dramatically. It now looks as though we might be on the way to healing the ozone layer. We need to do something like that for CO2. It is not going to happen because businesses think that it's the right thing to do. Businesses tend to do what is right for the business, not right for the planet. That said, however, there are a lot of businesses that are taking the lead on this because they realize that it's not economically it's economically detrimental to not do something about it, because their costs become more as the drama of climate change unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
And individuals need to have their voices heard and say, these are the kinds of things that we want because we care about this issue. For example, consumers certainly have some interest because the Toyota Prius has become an incredibly well-selling car in North America. People are on waiting lists to get this car because they feel that it is important. And I don't think that that just has to do with high gas prices, because it's been true since the cars came on the market. So consumers are interested. Clearly, we need more education for people to understand climate change. It's a very complex issue. There's a lot of messaging out there on it that is not correct, that confuses people. But governments have to take a leadership role in this, because we're talking about substantial effects to not only constituencies in the developed world, but really dramatic impacts to the developing world and in our global economy. Those are going to impact everyone.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a bit about what your experience was like in Montreal and what you saw happening there?
Well, I'm an environmental scientist. I'm a conservation biologist.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually there predominantly to follow a track called adaptation, which is how do we change the way we establish development plans and conservation plans in light of climate change. We know that we're locked into this potentially 1.4 degree Celsius change already, and that means that we're going to be seeing more of the types of effects that I talked about earlier in the program, and we know we need to change the way we do things in response to that. So I was there listening to talks on that and interacting with people as they're planning things, and it's becoming an incredibly growing issue. This is the first convention that I've been to. However, I've heard that historically this issue hasn't gotten a lot of attention because the key thing, obviously, is mitigation, because adaptation can't do very much. But we now know that adaptation has to be a part of it, because failing to address this will mean that development efforts and conservation efforts won't be successful.
Mm-hmm. On the topic of adaptation, can you talk a bit about this term that's becoming more popular nowadays, which is environmental refugees?
Mm-hmm.
I know in the IPCC report, they said that by 2050, it may be likely that there may be upwards of 150 million environmental refugees. And I'm not sure if that's a worst-case scenario or not. I wonder if you can talk about what kind of scenarios are likely to occur in the next 30, 40, 50 years, and who are the most likely to be affected?
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing is that obviously poorer countries are going to be more affected.
Mm-hmm.
Richer countries can take action to ameliorate some of these effects. They can build seawalls. They can increase pumping efforts. They can move communities to higher ground for sea level rise. They can rebuild after storms. They can import food if there's drought. But poorer countries have fewer options. Sort of the first line places that are being impacted and are already experiencing environmental refugees from climate change are small island nations. Places in the Pacific like Tuvalu, they're already planning leaving the islands because sea level rise will first get rid of their fresh water by inundating any aquifers that they have, although they're mostly using rainwater, and covering their land, they'll losing land mass. Additionally, communities along the Arctic are already starting to move, especially in Alaska, where historically sea ice has protected the coast from winter storm erosion. But now that there isn't sea ice during the winter storm season, the large waves and storm surge are causing erosion of their villages. And houses have been moved for years now, and now they're planning moving entire cities.